Today's scripture is part of the letter from St. Paul to his son in the faith, Timothy. In 2 Timothy chapter 4, verses 6 through 8. In your chair Bible, I lost my place here. Oh, it's on page 200. In the New Testament, and I'm reading from the Common English Bible. St. Paul is talking about the end of his life. I'm already being poured out like a sacrifice to God, and the time of my death is near. I have fought the good fight, finished the race, and kept the faith. At last, the champion's wreath that is awarded for the righteousness is waiting for me. The Lord, who is the righteous judge, is going to give it to me on that day. He's giving it not only to me, but also to all those who have set their heart on waiting for his appearance. The word of God for the people of God.
Thanks be to God.
It is good to be with you this morning. I was, last night, was celebrating the fact that I was going to be able to preach to you this morning, because that means that I'm taking a sermon out of the barrel, and I didn't have the usual Saturday night jitters. But I decided, just in case, I'd better sit down and take a look at the PowerPoint and my notes. And to my horror, I found out that the two did not match, that my script included slides that weren't on the PowerPoint, and the PowerPoint had a slide that I didn't refer to in the script. So about 8:30, I sent David a revised PowerPoint and script, and he was on the ball this morning, and we're going to have the correct version on the screen. This sermon is the last in a series I preached at Granville called Pilgrimage into the Last Third of Life. When I, this summer in early July, was the fifth anniversary of my father's death, I was remembering back to the funeral or memorial service, and the family was gathered in an anteroom waiting to be led by the funeral director and the pastor into the sanctuary. And as I looked around at my family, I realized that I was the oldest male Fitzgerald. I realized that with my dad's passing, I had become the patriarch of the Fitzgerald clan. And my first response to that was, I'm too young to be a patriarch. As I was thinking about that this time, I counted up the years and realized that even if I outlive my father by a decade, I am in my last third of life. It was that realization that prompted me to do the sermon series on the pilgrimage into the last third of life. This sermon is about leaving a legacy. Not a material legacy, but a spiritual legacy. Clyde was witty, charming. He was the life of the party. Everyone loved Clyde, and Clyde loved everyone else. Clyde's life was relatively easy. He managed to avoid many of the slings and arrows that come one's way as one grows in life. He had a successful career. He had a wonderful family. Life was good for Clyde. And he liked life and liked everyone in his life. And everyone liked and loved Clyde. Until the diminishments of old age, which inevitably set in for all of us, set in for Clyde. Clyde was not prepared for a life of pain, confined to a bed. And he became bitter and nasty. He alienated all of his family and his friends, save a few. At the nursing home where Clyde lived, each shift of nurses' aides would go through a ritual in which they would tear up pieces of paper into varying lengths, and then the nurse's aide with the most seniority would hold them in his hand like this so the others couldn't see which one was the longer one. They would draw the slips of paper out, and the shortest one, whoever got the shortest one, had to take care of Clyde. Even the few friends that he had left, when they visited him, Clyde would be nasty and berate them for not visiting more often. That's one way one can leave a legacy. Here's another. Paul suffered most of his adult life, and much of his suffering was the result of his behavior. He felt utterly called to preach Jesus Christ as Lord. Now, that doesn't seem like a problem for us living in the United States of America in the year 2013, when we can gather to worship, we can proclaim Jesus as Lord without anyone else, including the government, batting an eyelash. But in Paul's day, to proclaim Christ as Lord was an act of treason. For Caesar, the head of the government, was worshipped as a god. To proclaim anyone else god was an act of treason. Paul also suffered because, so he was imprisoned, he was flogged, he suffered shipwrecks. In one passage, he sums up all of this by saying, I have suffered so much for the gospel, been in prison frequently, been flogged severely. 5 times I received from the religious authorities the 40 lashes minus one. Over and over and over again, I was exposed to death. And at the end of his life, after all of that, he says, I am being poured out like a drink offering, and the time of my departure is near. I have fought the good fight. I have finished the race. I have kept the faith. Paul might have also added the words, I have left a legacy. How do you want to be remembered? As Crabby Clyde or Peaceful Paul? How each of us will be remembered will be determined by how we regard the last third of life. Is it a dreary death march or a sacred journey? Whether we end life as Crabby Clyde or Peaceful Paul, whether we experience aging as a dreary death march or a sacred journey, that is all entirely within our province to choose. Let me explain. Think, if you will, a time when you were on the shores of Lake Michigan, maybe in November when the waves are 6 and 7 feet high. And if you'll think back to the waves crashing on the sea, on the shore of the beach, and if you can't imagine that, look at the slide. On the surface, when there's a storm, the sea or the Lake Michigan will look something like the slide on the left. But if you go down deep enough below the surface, it will be calm and peaceful, like the slide on the right. That is the way it is for persons of faith. We do experience physical and emotional storms in the last third of life. However, like the sea, down deep in the depths of our soul where Christ resides, there is a place of peace and tranquility. In other words, for persons of faith, outer circumstances do not determine our inner reality. We can choose to stay on the stormy surface or search the depths of our souls. We can choose to be a Crabby Clyde or a Peaceful Paul. Now, there is one caveat. It takes hard work. The stormier our life, the more severe the diminishments of aging, the harder the work. I visited a parishioner who was celebrating her 90th birthday, and I said, "Julia, how is it to be 90? And she said, "It's hard. I've never worked so hard in my life. But you know what, Pastor Tom? Life is not for sissies. Neither is it for the lazy. Life is not for sissies. Neither is it for old age is not for sissies. Neither is it for the lazy. We do have difficult work to do. And the first thing we need to do is to deny our egocentric impulses, which tend to become stronger as we age. Lynn and I had the pleasure and the privilege to preside at the wedding of Constance and Randy. A friend of ours took pictures of that wedding, and at a gathering of our preacher friends, she was showing us the pictures, and I looked at one that was a shot of Lynn and I standing together and Randy and Constance with their backs to the camera facing us. And the thing that I noticed was the sunlight shining off and I said, "Oh my gosh, I'm bald. I'm bald as a cue ball, I'm bald." And I went on and on about how being bald, and finally the person who, our friend who took the picture, turned to me and said, "Tom, the picture's not about you." As we age, the impulse to see ourselves as the subject of the picture increases. And one of the efforts we have to put forth as we get into the last third of life is to deny that egocentric impulse. The second thing we need to do is find a way to forgive those who have wronged us. Whenever I say something like that in a sermon, I always feel like I need to add this. There is a difference between forgiveness and reconciliation. Reconciliation is the work of the person who has done the wrong. Forgiveness is the work of the person who has been wronged. I can forgive whether or not the person who has wronged me has sought reconciliation, whether or not they have come to me and said, "I'm sorry." I can forgive them, for forgiveness is the hard work of deciding that I'm not going to allow that wrong to affect the way I live any longer. Forgiveness is accepting the power we have to let that wrong go and to live our life despite it. We need to deny our egocentric impulses. We need to find a way to forgive those who have wronged us. And we need to develop a sense of gratitude. One of the things I enjoyed about preaching this series was after every sermon, I got into at least one conversation with someone who was older than I, telling me about some aspect of the topic of that day's sermon. And after preaching this sermon and saying that we have to develop a sense of gratitude, one of my 90-year-old parishioners came up to me and said, "You know, that's exactly right. I could barely get out of bed this morning. And it was such a struggle to get dressed and to get my breakfast and to wait for my ride to bring me to church. I had a hard time getting out of the car. Thank God we have that elevator, or I never would have made it to the sanctuary. But you know what, Pastor Tom? I am so grateful to be here. Because there are persons in my retirement community who are 15 years younger than I, and they can't get out of bed at all. I am grateful to be here, Pastor Tom." As we deny our egocentric impulses, as we find forgiveness, as we develop a sense of gratitude, we will find that as our physical world narrows, our spiritual lives expand. I mentioned the death of my father, and this being the fifth anniversary, this summer was the fifth anniversary, got me thinking about Dad and his life of faith. Dad was one of those silent types. He did not speak much about his faith. In fact, he didn't speak much at all. And after he died, my mother and I were reading an article that described the symptoms of Asperger's syndrome, which is a form of autism. Yes, thank you. And that description fit Dad to the T, and we realized that Dad was silent, not because he didn't want to talk, but because he had a hard time doing so. However, I had two fights with my father in my teenage years, and one of them was about whether or not I was going to go to church. When I became an adolescent and joined the church, I took seriously the fact that I could decide now whether or not I was going to go to church or not. Because after all, I was a member. Just like my parents, equal to my parents in the sight of God in the church, I could serve on any committee. I could make my offering. I could worship, and I could decide to do that or not. Now, my parents impressed upon me the fact that I was living in their house. And they got to set the rules of the house. And the rules of the house for adolescent teenage boys was that there are three things that go on at that time in a Methodist church. There was Sunday school, there was worship, and there was youth group. And I could decide to go to two out of those three. Well, this particular Sunday, I decided, because I had a lot of homework, that I was going to skip the evening part because it wasn't youth group, it was a potluck, and they were having a gospel quartet sing after the potluck, and gospel music was not something that teenage boys listened to in the 60s. So I went to Sunday school, and I went to worship and suffered through that sermon. And I went home and ate lunch and watched the football game. And just as I was sitting down to do my homework, my dad announced to me that I was going to go to church to the potluck and listen to the gospel quartet. And I told him that I'd already done my obligation. I had been to Sunday school, and I had been to worship, and I listened to that sermon, and that was it. Well, needless to say, I went to the potluck. Dad was mostly silent about his faith, but he impressed upon me that sometimes there were things more important than your regular Sunday obligation, that sometimes you had to extend yourself for the sake of the community. Dad in his retirement, worked for Habitat for Humanity. He was up at 7 o'clock every morning that there was work to be done on a Habitat house, and by 7:30 he was at the house working. And he worked for several years until his co-workers noticed that he was huffing and puffing by the time he got halfway up a ladder. And they were concerned that he was going to have a heart attack on their shift. And so they arranged with the higher-ups in Habitat to retire Dad. And they gave him a big banquet, and they gave him a plaque, and they congratulated him for his years of service, and then said, "Jack, you do not need to come back." Well, that left Dad with a bunch of time on his hands, and so one of the persons who sat in front of him in worship heard Dad singing and said, "Jack, you need to be in the choir." And because my mother had been telling my dad that for 60 years, he didn't respond. But when Joe told Dad he ought to be in the choir, Dad got in the choir. And Dad was so dedicated to that choir, and his grandchildren will tell you that if they had a soccer game or a baseball game on Wednesday night, Grandpa was not going to be there because that's when choir rehearsal was. And if you wanted Grandpa and Grandma to come to your church on Christmas Eve, that wasn't going to happen because the choir always sang a cantata on Christmas Eve, and Dad had to be there. Even though when it came to speaking of his faith, Dad was silent, the way he lived spoke volumes. The way we live our lives will speak volumes to our children, our grandchildren, and God willing, our great-grandchildren. We can do the difficult work, the difficult spiritual work of aging. And when we do, we can say, along with the Apostle Paul, "I have fought the good fight. I have finished the race. I have kept the faith. I am leaving a legacy." It is so.